Welcome to the Family Farm Podcast, priority topics for family medicine and community pharmacy. Hi everyone, my name is Tina Lian and I'm a fourth year pharmacy student at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Billy Lin, I am a family practice resident at UBC. So today we'll be covering the treatment of type 2 diabetes. And before we get into the drug classes, I'd like to just quickly review the CDA 2013 guidelines on diabetes treatment. A diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, it's recommended that every patient get started with lifestyle intervention first, and everyone should be considered for metformin therapy. For patients below A1C of 8.5%, they could rely on lifestyle management first without metformin. But regardless of their choices, if they do not reach their target at 2 to 3 months, then they should start or increase their metformin. For patients above A1C of 8.5, they should start metformin right away and consider initial combination with another anti-hyperglycemic agent if their A1C is significantly elevated. For patients with symptomatic hyperglycemia, then they should start insulin plus or minus metformin. And if patients do not reach their glycemic target within 2 to 3 months, it's recommended that they consider adding a second-line agent. And these classes include alpha-glucosidase inhibitor, or acarbose, incretin agents including the DPP-4 inhibitors and the GLP-1 receptor agonists, or insulin, or insulin secreted clogs, including meglitinide and sulfonylurea, and finally the TZD medications. The A1C lowering power of these classes are different, and the insulin are the strongest to lower the A1C level, followed by the insulin secreted clogs and the incretin agents. The TZD is also fairly strong in lowering A1C levels, but acarbose is the weakest in lowering A1C. In terms of their risk for causing hypoglycemia, the insulin and insulin secreted clogs are the highest risk, and the incretin agents, TZD, and the acarbose are less likely to cause hypoglycemia. In terms of weight gain as a side effect, insulin and insulin secreted clogs are known to cause significant weight gain as well as the TZD medications. So for patients who are overweight, these agents may not be as desirable as acarbose or incretin agents, which are neutral or even beneficial in weight loss, as well metformin is neutral for weight gain or loss. Other therapeutic considerations, for acarbose, it's known to cause GI side effects, and they're best for postprandial control of blood glucose because of the mechanism of action. And Tina will cover the mechanism of action of these medications a little bit later. The incretin agents are the newest on the market, and their cost is the highest among these second-line agents. They also cause some GI side effects. For insulin, there is a variety of different preparations of insulin, and their costs are varying, and their duration of action are also different. We'll be covering insulin in a separate podcast, and today we'll be focusing on the other second-line agents. For sulfonylureas, glycoside is associated with less hypoglycemic events than glyburide, and these drugs are older, so their costs are a little bit less than the other medications. Finally, the TZD medications are known to cause a variety of complications such as congestive heart failure, edema, fractures, and bladder cancer, and cardiovascular controversy regarding their safety.
Thanks, Billy. So now I will go over each class of medications for the treatment of diabetes. The classes I will be going over are, the first one is bigonides, that's including metformin, sulfonylureas, TZDs, or known as thiazolidinediones, meglitinides, alpha-glucosidase inhibitors, also known as acarbose, dipeptidyl peptidase 4 inhibitors, or DPP-4, and lastly, the glucagon-like peptide 1 analogs, more commonly known as GLP-1 analogs. So for the first category, which is bigonides, common drug in this category is metformin. Its mechanism of action is that it decreases hepatic glucose production, increases insulin sensitivity and cellular glucose uptake and utilization. The specific mechanism of action is not well known. However, its effect has strong evidence supporting it, suggesting that it can reduce macrovascular endpoints and mortality, especially in overweight patients. So because of all these strong evidence, it is often used as first choice for uncomplicated patients with a newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes mellitus. Common dosing range is 500 to 2,500 milligrams per day, divided twice a day or three times a day. So it's usually starting at a low dose and going slowly to titrate up the dose. And there is little additional benefit above 1,500 milligrams per day. Common side effects include nausea, diarrhea, and abdominal discomfort. So to avoid these GI side effects, you want to start at a low dose and increase the dose every 2 to 4 weeks. Also, a 3 times a day dosing option for larger doses can also decrease GI intolerances. Other side effects include anorexia, metallic taste, lactic acidosis, especially if the patient has hepatic or renal disease. Now, to avoid lactic acidosis, metformin can be held pre-op or when imaging contrast agents are being given to avoid the possibilities of acute renal failure that may increase the risk of lactic acidosis. Also, long-term use of metformin can decrease B12 and folate absorption. So for patients that are more prone to a decrease in B12, they can consider oral B12 supplement. Metformin also has no weight gain. Weight gain is a common side effect, which I will talk about for the other oral antihyperglycemic agents. Drug interaction with metformin includes its effect with alcohol. So alcohol can potentiate hypoglycemic effect. Also, metformin can potentiate other oral antihyperglycemic agents. So metformin is contraindicated in patients with hepatic impairment, renal impairment, previous lactic acidosis. Also, you want to avoid using metformin for patients with a renal function less than 30 mL per minute. Now, for those patients with a creatinine clearance of less than 60 mL per minute, you have to use metformin with caution. Other contraindications include patients with acute decompensated heart failure, acute illness or dehydration, and anemia. Now for the next class of medication, the sulfonylureas. These include chlorpropamide, glycoside, glimepiride, glyburide, and tobutamide. So its mechanism involves stimulating both the basal and meal-stimulated insulin release. This increase in beta cell insulin release causing more peripheral glucose utilization and decreases the hepatic gluconeogenesis. So there's two generations of sulfonylureas. The first generation includes chlorpropamide and tobutamide. And second generation, which is the more commonly used ones, are glycoside, glimepiride, and glyburide. As for the common dosing range, for a glycoside, it's 40 to 320 milligrams per day, and it's usually given in 2 divided doses if the daily dose is greater or equal to 160 milligrams. For long-acting glycoside, also known as diamicrone MR, common dosing is 30 to 120 milligrams once daily. And for glyburide, it's usually 2.5 to 20 milligrams per day. And this is also given in 2 divided doses if daily dose is greater than 10 milligrams. For these doses, you can titrate them every 1 to 2 weeks. Side effect for glycoside involves prolonged hypoglycemia and weight gain. As for glyburide, it also has weight gain and prolonged hypoglycemia. However, the risk of hypoglycemia may be greater when compared to glycoside and glimepiride, especially in elderly or patients with renal impairment. Other side effects include sulfa skin reaction, where the patient may have a rash or photosensitivity, and tooth discoloration. So when comparing second generation to first generation sulfonylureas, second generation, especially for glyburide, has more hypoglycemic effect in patients. As for first generation sulfonylurea, especially chlorpropamide, it is not recommended to patients since it increases in blood pressure and retinopathy. And this is according to the UK PDS 33 trial. And now to drug interactions. The hypoglycemic effect from sulfonylureas can be potentiated by medications including salicylates, NSAIDs, quinolones, sulfonamides, and monoamine oxidase inhibitors. Also, beta blockers can mask hypoglycemic symptoms. And again, when comparing first generation and second generation, there's more interactions with first generation sulfonylureas. And one of them is clopropamide can interact with ethanol, alcohol, and that can cause disulfiram reaction. So sulfonylureas should be used cautiously in elderly, especially because of the hypoglycemic risk, obese patients, patients with cardiac toxicity, hyperinsulinemia, hyponatremia, or those with G6P deficiency. It is contraindicated in patients with type 1 diabetes and pregnancy. And to the next class, the TZD, or the thiazolidinediones, two common medications within this class are the pioglitazone and rosiglitazone. Now, RxFiles called it the insulin sensitizer. So how it works is it acts as the agonist at the PPAR gamma receptor located on the cell nucleus. So this affects gene expression in the cell and ultimately enhances insulin sensitivity and lower blood glucose and circulating insulin levels. It can also decrease hepatic output of glucose, increases peripheral insulin uptake, and enhanced fat cell sensitivity to insulin. However, since it acts on the nucleus, it takes around 4 to 6 weeks before an effect is shown. Thus, it is recommended to adjust the dose around 2 months. Common dosing range for pioglitazone is 15 to 45 milligrams once daily, and for rosiglitazone is 4 to 8 milligrams daily in 1 to 2 doses. Now, the big side effect of TZD is its effect in heart failure, especially when used with insulin together. Other side effects include fractures, fluid retention, and that's including edema, macular edema, increased subcutaneous fat deposition, macular degeneration, and weight gain. And for rosiglitazone, it does have more ischemic events. Now, the TZDs can potentiate the effect of other antihyperglycemic agents. Other interactions are the effect with gemfibrozil, where gemfibrozil can inhibit the metabolism and increase the plasma concentration of TZDs. If using TZD with rifampin, the opposite effect will be seen, where the TZD plasma level will decrease. And of course, because we mentioned the side effect of heart failure, you want to avoid using TZD in patients with heart failure. And to the next class, meglitinides, and that's including nateclinide and rapaglinide. Now, this class of medications, they act by binding to the beta cell and stimulating insulin release at a different site than how sulfonylureas bind. It promotes insulin release, but the action is shorter than sulfonylurea. It is found that the fasting plasma glucose drops after 1 month of using meglitinides, and specifically, nateclinide has a weaker effect on A1C when compared to rapaglinide. Common dosing range for nateclinide is 60 to 180 milligrams 3 times a day, and it's taken either right before or half an hour before meals. And for rapaglinide, it's 0.5 to 4 milligrams and also either right before or half an hour before meals. Common side effect is hypoglycemia, especially if a meal is not taken right after taking the medication. And for drug interactions, meglitinides are metabolized by the CYP3A4 enzyme. Thus, CYP3A4 inhibitors and inducers can greatly affect the concentration of this medication in the body. So for strong CYP3A4 inhibitors can increase meglitinide concentration. And strong CYP3A4 inhibitors include imidazole antifungals, macrolides, and protease inhibitors. Now for CYP3A4 inducers, and that includes rifampin, carbamazepine, and barbiturates, they can reduce the concentration of meglitinides in the body. And of course, patients with type 1 diabetes or those who are pregnant are contraindicated in taking the medication. And on to alpha-glucosidase inhibitors, or acarbose. So its mechanism is that it inhibits alpha-glucosidases in the brush border of small intestine. This delays the digestion of starches and disaccharides, which reduce postprandial glucose levels. However, it does not significantly reduce intestinal lactase. Common dosing range is 50 to 100 milligrams 3 times a day with each meal. You also want to start at a low dose and increase slowly. The dose can be increased every 4 to 8 weeks. Common side effects include flatulence, diarrhea, abdominal pain, cramps, and nausea. So it is also worth noting that it does not cause hypoglycemia, but can increase the risk of hypoglycemia when combined with insulin or in insulin secretagogues. So when you combine them together, it can cause a significant GI side effect. As for drug interaction, it can also potentiate other anti-hyperglycemic agents. For example, it can decrease metformin bioavailability. It can also decrease the digoxin effect if used with the digoxin together. Contraindications are irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease. And the next class I will be talking about is the dipeptidyl peptidase 4 inhibitors. And that's including saxagliptin and sitagliptin, which is also known as Januvia. So to know its mechanism, we first have to know the action of incretin and GLP-1. Incretins are a group of GI hormones that can stimulate decrease in the blood glucose levels. And GLP-1 is a type of incretin hormone. So GLP-1 can stimulate insulin release and also inhibits glucagon release. So it stimulates insulin release by acting on a glucose-dependent pathway. And it inhibits glucagon release by a G-protein coupled receptor. So in the end, the blood glucose is lowered. However, there are enzymes that can deactivate incretin and GLP-1, and this includes DPP-4. So by using DPP-4 inhibitors, like what we're talking about in this section, it blocks DPP-4 enzyme, increases the availability of GLP-1, as well as other potentially active peptides, and in the end results in a lowered blood glucose. The common dosing range for saxagliptin is 5 mg once daily, and for sitagliptin is 100 mg once daily. Now these medications may be taken with or without food. As for the side effect profile, it lacks long-term safety and efficacy evidence. However, common side effects seen are nasopharyngitis, hypersensitivity reactions, and in rare situations, patients may experience pancreatitis. There's an overall minimal drug interactions involved if using this medication. However, it is also worth to know that the clearance of saxagliptin is reduced by strong CYP3A4 or 5 inhibitors. And that's again imidazole antifungals, macrolides, and protease inhibitors. Now, since it's reduced by strong CYP3A4 and 5 inhibitors, it can also be enhanced by a strong CYP3A4 or 5 inducers, and that's including rifampin. Now, on the other hand, sitagliptin or Januvia, it is not inhibited by CYP450 isoenzymes, so there is a lower potential for drug interactions. And to the last class of medication I'll be talking about, and that's glucagon-like peptide 1 analogs, more commonly known as GLP-1 analogs. And that's including liraglutide and exenatide. So its mechanism is that it is structurally and functionally the same as human GLP-1, and when administered, it can increase GLP-1 action by around fivefold. Now these medications are different to the ones I just mentioned before because they are administered subcutaneously. For exenatide, the initial dosing is 5 micrograms twice a day subcutaneously and can increase to 10 micrograms twice a day subcutaneously after 1 month if required. And for liraglutide, the initial dosing is 0.6 milligrams once daily subcutaneously and can increase to 1.2 to 1.8 milligrams once daily subcutaneously. Common side effects include nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Rare side effect is acute pancreatitis, which is similar to the previous class I just discussed, and that's the DPP-4 inhibitors. So when comparing GLP-1 analogs to the DPP-4 inhibitors, GLP-1 analogs can lower A1C more, but it does have more nausea side effect upon initiation. It may also cause weight loss. And for drug interactions, exenatide can reduce the rate of absorption of some medications. On the other hand, liraglutide has no significant interactions. And for some cautionary notes, when using GLP-1 analogs, you have to be cautious in patients with heart rhythm disturbances and severe renal impairment. It is contraindicated in pregnancy and those with personal or family history of medullary thyroid carcinoma or multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome, type 2. So before closing this episode, I want to talk more on managing hypoglycemia for patients on antihyperglycemic agents. You definitely have noticed that a lot of these medications have a big side effects on hypoglycemia. So it is very important for patients to know when they have hypoglycemia, what are the signs and symptoms of hypoglycemia, and how to manage it. So common symptoms of hypoglycemia includes tremors, palpitations, sweating, excessive hunger, headache, irritability, and even visual disturbances. Now, as I have mentioned before, beta blockers can block some signs of hypoglycemia as well. For mild to moderate hypoglycemia, the patient may be able to self-treat. And the treatment recommendations are, first, they can use a 15 grams carbohydrate, either glucose or sucrose tablets. And by taking this 15 grams, they should experience an increase in blood glucose around 2.1 millimoles per liter in 20 minutes. Examples of 15 grams carbohydrate includes 3/4 cup of juice or regular soft drink, 3 teaspoons of table sugar or honey, 6 lifesavers, 3 sugar cubes, 9 jelly beans, and 4 of the 4 grams glucose tablets, or commonly known as Dex4. Now, after taking this 15 grams of carbohydrate, the patient should wait for 15 minutes, retest their blood glucose, and retreat with another 15 grams glucose or sucrose if the blood glucose is less than 4 millimoles per liter. Now, after all this glucose treatment, another carbohydrate-containing snack should be taken within 1 hour. If the meal is more than 1 hour away, a snack with 15 grams of carbohydrate and protein source is recommended. For those patients on acarbose, the treatment may be a little different. As I mentioned before, acarbose can impair the absorption of complex carbohydrates, and this includes sucrose. So for them, they should focus on obtaining carbohydrate from glucose source and not sucrose. So examples of glucose are glucose tablets, milk, and honey. And that's the end of this episode.
Well, thank you, Tina, for bringing us a great episode on antihypoglycemics.
I'm glad you like it.
Of course I do. And I look forward to your next episode on insulin therapy.
Yeah, so on our next episode, I'll go over different insulin, including the long-acting ones, intermediate ones, and rapid and fast-acting ones.
And I have also picked up a few clinical pearls from endocrinologists that I've met over the years, and I'll also contribute a few of those in our next episode.
Stay tuned to that. It's going to be an exciting episode.
So until then, thank you for listening.
And we'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Family Farm Podcast. Please leave your feedback and check out our show notes at fppodcast.org.